Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today we open with an update on the largest brush fire in California so far this year, which caused evacuations in the Dulzura area of East County over the weekend, and now CAL FIRE has opened a criminal probe into the cause of that fire, which started just outside a shooting range. The weekend fire points up the importance of clearing defensible space around your home. And fortunately, the county now has help for low-income seniors and disabled people who need help to clear brush around their homes. We'll tell you how to apply on today's show. On Crime Beat, hear about a burglary suspect in Lemon Grove who wound up dead after sheriff's detectives used tasers multiple times when he refused to obey commands. Hear about a lawsuit filed by California's Attorney General and other states that seeks to protect access to health care for low-income Californians. We'll also have an update on the latest legislative action on a bill that would allow 5G wireless cells atop streetlight poles in communities statewide. A tick-borne illness called Powassan virus is proving to be more deadly than Lyme disease. While it's not yet found in California, hear why some health officials are concerned. If you live in the Padre Dam Water District, your rates may soon be going up substantially over the next 5 years, even though the district already has rates nearly as high as Flint, Michigan. Learn why the district says it needs to raise rates and when public meetings and a hearing will be held where you can voice your views. If you live in the 619 area code, you'll soon have to dial 1 and the area code even if you're making a local call. Find out why on today's show. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories of interest to consumers today, including threats to net neutrality and details on how the Republican health care bill would harm many seniors. Today we'll be re-airing our interview with Victor Crosswaite Contreras, talking about the upcoming Twain Fest in Old Town and performing a dramatic reading to bring to life Joaquin Murrieta, an infamous bandito from Old California. On our agricultural report, learn about a bill introduced in Sacramento to help protect farm workers from deportation. Then we'll have an update on a fatal shooting on the Viejas Reservation that's resulted in a murder charge against an Alpine woman. And finally, on Destination East County, we'll have all the top festivals and events coming up, including family-friendly happenings and some creative Father's Day ideas. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine on KNSJ. A fast-moving brush fire provided a frightening reminder over the weekend that fire season in our region is now year-round. The Gate Fire began on Saturday near a shooting range along Highway 94 south of Habul. By Sunday afternoon, the wildfire had charred over 2,000 acres and was 70% contained. Now, CAL FIRE reveals that a criminal probe has been launched after a witness at a shooting range posted video on social media that he claims showed 4 people who started the fire. It is unclear from the video whether the fire was caused by shooting or some other means, but the 4 people can be seen looking closely at a very small flame just outside the shooting range and then walking away as it spread. The fire forced evacuation of the Thousand Trails campground off Otay Lakes Road and shut down Highway 94 between Honey Springs Road and State Route 188 all weekend, causing residents very long delays. A voluntary evacuation order to 77 households and businesses in Dulzura was issued late Saturday, with a temporary evacuation center set up at the Viejas Casino in Alpine, and an overnight center for evacuees later opened at Otay Ranch High School in Chula Vista. That's hours away. A traffic accident caused delays of several hours in Jamul, adding to residents' long delays and fears. For many who lost homes or narrowly survived the 2007 firestorms, the view of smoke-filled skies also brought back traumatic memories. A Chula Vista police officer directing traffic was struck by a motorist and transported to a hospital with injuries. but all of this may have been preventable. Witnesses have told East County Magazine that the fire appeared to start right outside a shooting range on Federal Bureau of Land Management property known as the Pink Gate Range. A CAL FIRE official also confirmed to Reporting San Diego that this is where the fire started, and hence how the Gate Fire got its name. CAL FIRE has banned shooting on state-controlled lands during dry conditions such as this, and has long been attempting to persuade the Bureau of Land Management to ban shooting on its properties, too. Multiple small fires have already occurred in this area caused by shooting, and residents voiced outrage then and again now, saying it's only a matter of time before homes or lives are lost because of shots fired into tinder dry brush. Area resident Robin Brailsford reported that even while firefighters battled the Gate Fire and Highway 94 remained closed to residents, she saw shooters in the Donahue Mountain area on Bureau of Land Management property shooting on Sunday morning. "How did they get in?" she asked, noting that she was locked out of her community all day. Brailsford states, "This selfish insanity has got to stop." In an email sent to Supervisor Diane Jacob, she implores, "Shut it down, please."
This is Jordan Damond with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. Fire season is fast approaching. The county's Defensible Space Assistance Program provides help to low-income seniors and physically disabled people. If you are physically and financially unable to maintain the 100 feet of defensible space around your home mandated by the state, this program can help with brush and tree trimming and thinning, raking of dead leaves and pine needles, chipping of removed vegetation, on-site education about effective defensible space, and an initial one-day defensible space cleanup. Services are performed by professional contractors who are bonded and insured. To qualify for the Defensible Space Assistance Program, you must be over 65 years old or have a medical physical disability, making it impossible for you to do the cleanup work yourself. You must also be deemed financially unable to hire a contractor. For a one-person household, that's an income less than $29,750 a year or $34,000 a year for a two-person household. This program is funding dependent and services are offered on a first-come, first-served basis, as the program funds are available. Dead tree removal is not included in this service. This program is offered to the Fire Safe Council San Diego County in partnership with the Resource Conservation District of Greater San Diego County. Funding is currently provided by a grant from San Diego Gas and Electric. Please call the Fire Safe Council at 619-562-0096 to sign up.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Gene Carpenter with a Crime Beat report. A 54-year-old African-American man has died after an altercation with sheriff's deputies in Lemon Grove, in which tasers were fired multiple times. Deputies had received several 911 calls Sunday morning from residents on Lemon Grove Way who reported the man was seen jumping over fences into backyards and trying to gain entry into townhomes. The callers also said the suspect was acting as if he might be under the influence of drugs. Deputies ordered the suspect to lie down several times, but he refused, says Lieutenant Kenneth Nelson with the Sheriff's Homicide Unit. Nelson says both deputies deployed their tasers, striking the suspect, who dropped to the ground but ignored commands and tried to stand up again. So a second round of tasers was deployed, still with minimal effect. Deputies finally managed to wrestle the suspect into submission and place him into handcuffs. Because tasers had been used, deputies called for paramedics to respond and evaluate the suspect per department policy. Nelson says, during this time, the suspect was alert and continued to struggle with deputies. But after paramedics started treating the suspect, he became unresponsive. He was immediately transported to a local hospital. While on the way to the hospital, CPR was initiated. Medical intervention was continued at the hospital, but the suspect passed away shortly before noon. The name of the suspect is being withheld pending notification of his family. An autopsy by the medical examiner's office will determine the cause of death. This is Gene Carpenter with a health report. California Attorney General Javier Becerra has filed a legal action along with 14 other states to challenge the Trump administration and protect health care access for millions of Americans. The states seek to intervene in a lawsuit filed by House Republicans against the Obama administration to undermine affordability of health insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans' lawsuit, House versus Price, would eliminate stable funding that the Affordable Care Act created to protect millions of working low-income families by providing them with access to more affordable health care coverage. Experts predict that the mere threat to end this funding could destabilize the health care market and increase premiums by 19% on average nationwide and up to 21% in states that have not expanded Medicaid, the Kaiser Foundation predicts. House Republicans' lawsuit challenges the legality of those cost-sharing subsidies. A district court judge ruled in favor of the House Republicans, but the ruling was appealed and subsidies were allowed to continue pending appeal. After the election, the House asked that the case be held in suspension while President Trump had time to decide what to do about the case. Trump has threatened to shut down the federal government and take away health care subsidies. Meanwhile, House Republicans voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, an action that must next be considered by the Senate, which might block the bill as written. In President Trump's own words, the House versus Price lawsuit could explode the Affordable Health Care Act, even without the Senate voting to repeal it. That would leave millions of Americans without affordable health care coverage. States would be left to pick up the pieces. California's Attorney General says, "No parent should worry if they can afford to take their child to a doctor or hospital." President Trump's unpredictable behavior and lack of defense on the health care coverage of millions of Americans under the Affordable Care Act threatens to resurrect those fears of every parent, he adds. Here in California, over 5 million people now receive health care under the Affordable Care Act, including many who were previously uninsured. Since its inception, the percentage of Californians without health insurance has fallen from 17% in 2013 to just over 7% in 2016, an historic low. California has proven that the ACA works when state leaders make an earnest effort to make it work, according to Becerra. He concludes, "No one wants to return to the days when a child was denied care because of a pre-existing condition, when a woman was charged more than a man for the same health care plan, when you needed care the most and found you had reached your lifetime limit. My fellow attorneys general and I seek to intervene in House versus Price to defend each of these Americans."
Opponents of a bill intended to smooth the way for the rollout of next-generation cell technology are cautiously optimistic after a key committee put the measure on hold on Monday. The state Senate Finance Committee put Senate Bill 649 in the suspense file in the face of vocal opposition from groups concerned that the 5G technology emits harmful millimeter wave frequencies when compared with the 3G and 4G now commonly in use. Josh Hart with the group StopSmartMeters.org says the bill would limit local government's ability to use zoning laws to block the proliferation of these towers near schools, hospitals, and residential areas.
This bill has basically been written by the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association, the CTIA. This is their wish list. The local governments are the biggest impediment to them putting wireless wherever they want to.
Supporters of the bill say it will boost the economy by encouraging the spread of super-fast wireless connections in the Golden State. The bill already sailed through the Governance and Finance Committee, but faced determined opposition from advocates on Monday, who organized more than 175 people to call into the hearing on a central conference line and express their concern. A recent study by the National Toxicology Program found that male rats exposed to cell phone-like signals had a higher incidence of brain and heart tumors compared with a control group. Hart says other studies have linked 5G technology to skin and eye damage in humans.
Approximately 5 to 6% of the population has been injured in some way by electromagnetic fields. This is an acknowledged impairment in Sweden. Often these people's lives have been turned upside down. They've had to move into remote areas, lost jobs. This is a really serious and growing issue.
Hart says Santa Cruz and Marin counties and the League of California Cities have come out against the bill, which could be revived at any time before the end of the legislative session this summer. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Gene Carpenter with a health alert from East County Magazine. You've heard of Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and rabbit fever? All are diseases spread by ticks, and all have spread to our region after first starting elsewhere in the country. But now there's a tick-borne illness that's much deadlier than those ailments. It's called Palicin, or PAL for short. Most people who are bitten by a tick with the disease will never show symptoms, but of those who are infected with a Palicin virus and do have symptoms, about 15% of them will die, and half will suffer permanent neurological damage, says Dr. Jennifer Lyons, chief of neurological diseases and inflammatory diseases at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, CNN reports. The disease also comes on a lot faster than Lyme disease, which can take years to be diagnosed and decades to cause the most serious harm. By contrast, people bitten by a tick carrying Palicin usually become sick anywhere from a week to a month later with fever, headache, and flu-like symptoms, and sometimes a rash. Some develop seizures or encephalitis, which causes swelling of the brain and spinal cord. They may be unable to breathe on their own. Patients may lose consciousness or be disoriented. Palicin virus was first discovered in Ontario, Canada in 1958, but is now found in parts of the U.S. The good news is that so far, only 75 cases of Palicin have been reported in the past 10 years in the United States, and so far, all of those cases have been in the Northeast and the Great Lakes region. So the risk is highest if you're traveling to those areas, though concerns remain that the disease could spread west, like other tick-borne illnesses have done. Tick populations are growing due to warmer winters, and infection rates among deer are rising. The disease is carried by three types of ticks, including the deer tick. Infections are most likely from late spring through mid-fall, and people who are outdoors in brushy areas are at most risk. Palicin diseases can be diagnosed by laboratory tests of blood or spinal fluid to detect antibodies that the immune system makes against the viral infection. There is no vaccine and no effective treatment for Palicin, though IV fluids can be administered to reduce brain and spinal cord swelling. For now, the most effective strategy is prevention. If you are going to be outdoors in tick-infested areas, wear long sleeves and long pants, and be sure to use an insect repellent effective on ticks, meaning those with DEET, picaridin, or IR3535. Lemon eucalyptus oil has also been found effective. Using insect repellent applied to your skin will also protect you against Lyme disease, which, though usually less dangerous, is still debilitating and far more prevalent. At least 30,000 new cases are diagnosed each year in the United States, the Center for Disease Control reports, and some experts suggest the real number of cases could be 10 times higher. Repellents with DEET will only last a few hours. You can also treat clothing and gear with permethrin, which will last through several washings. When outdoors, avoid brush areas and tall grass if possible. Search for and remove ticks immediately before they have a chance to bite. Parents should check their children and be sure to look in their hair. Also check pets and clothing, removing ticks that you find. Bathe or shower within 2 hours after coming indoors if possible to wash off and find ticks. If you find a tick that has attached itself, the CDC recommends removing it with fine-tip tweezers to grasp the tick as close to the skin surface as possible. Pull up with steady, even pressure. After removing the tick, thoroughly clean the bite area and your hands with rubbing alcohol, an iodine scrub, or soap and water. If bitten, don't panic. The majority of ticks are not infected with Palicin or other diseases. But if you develop symptoms of Palicin or other tick-borne diseases such as Lyme disease, which is often characterized by a bullseye-shaped red rash, be sure to seek medical help and tell your doctor that you were bitten by a tick and where the bite occurred. To learn more about ticks and tick-related illnesses, you can visit cdc.gov/ticks.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
If you're in the Padre Dam Municipal Water District, your rates may soon rise substantially. The district already charges among the highest water rates in the nation, and yet the board is proposing another 5-year increase that officials say is necessary to maintain services. Padre has sent a notice out to its 24,000 customers outlining the rate hikes and the district's rationale for the increase. Starting in November, an average residential customer in Padre Dam's district who currently pays about $155 a month can expect their combined water and sewer monthly bill to rise by $3.74 a month. That's nearly $45 a year. Rates for condo owners, apartments, and commercial customers would also trend up through 2021. The 5-year rate hike will require approval of the district's board majority. The board will hold a public hearing on June 21st at 6 p.m. in the district's headquarters. Customers have been calling the district to voice displeasure about the prospect of paying more on their monthly bills. Padre Dam spokeswoman Melissa McChesney says people are upset, especially because many of them are using less water. But she adds that the district has fixed costs, no matter how much water it sells. The biggest fixed cost is maintenance and replacement of the district's 389 miles of pipes. Padre Dam also incurs higher costs because it has to pump water up more than 2,600 feet to places such as Alpine and Crest. That means maintaining pumping stations and paying for electricity to run them. Another factor is Padre Dam's dependence on outside sources for drinking water. The district gets 100% of its water from the San Diego County Water Authority. Padre Dam also depends on treating all of its sewage through the San Diego Metropolitan Wastewater System. Padre Dam has a smaller customer base than neighboring districts, so there are fewer customers to share increasing costs. Padre Dam customer Jesse Hughes, in a post on Nextdoor.com, said he moved to Santee from San Diego last August, and now he's paying monthly in this Padre Dam district what he used to pay every other month in the family's former home. He calls the rate hikes insane. Alan Carlisle, CEO of Padre Dam, said if demand for water remains constant, now that the drought is over, the district's rates should level off at some point. But costs for transporting, storing, and cleaning water will continue to increase along with other daily expenses, he notes. A survey in January 2015 by Food and Water Watch found Padre Dam's rates for a typical user were the second highest out of 500 water districts surveyed nationwide. That's based on average water use of 60,000 gallons a year. Padre's rates were nearly as high as the nation's highest water rates paid by customers in none other than Flint, Michigan. Flint gained notoriety for lead contamination in its water system that caused serious health problems for many residents and costly efforts to remediate that. The Food and Water Watch rate analysis didn't include sewage rates, which now cost an average Padre Dam customer about $55 a month, but are slated to increase to $58.55 starting November 1st if the board approves that proposed rate hike. Carlisle disputed that Padre Dam has the second highest water rates in the U.S. He says Padre is actually now the third or fourth highest in San Diego County alone. He adds that each district has unique characteristics, so it's an apples-to-oranges situation when trying to compare rates. McChesney said the district is doing whatever it can to keep the costs as low as possible. In 2011, Padre Dam reduced its staff by 19%, for example. Padre Dam is holding community meetings before the June 21st hearing to explain about proposed rates and give residents a chance to ask questions. If you want your voice to be heard, the next meetings will be on May 24th at 6 p.m. in the Alpine Community Center and on May 31st at 6 p.m. at the district's headquarters at Santee Lakes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
If you live in the area code 619 or 858, you'll have to dial 1 and the area code. Even for local calls starting in October, with the new system mandatory by April of next year. The problem is that the 619 area code is running out of new phone numbers to assign, while the 858 area has plenty, Patch.com reports. So the California Public Utilities Commission has decided to combine the two areas. That will delay for approximately 17 years the need to create a new area code and force some residents to change their phone numbers. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ Radio, this is Rebecca Williamson.
Cattle caused havoc in Lakeside last weekend, and that's no bull. Several cattle broke out of a pen, including multiple bulls. One bull wandered onto State Route 67, where it was struck by a motorist near Willow Road. The collision caused major damage to the Ford pickup truck driven by Vicki Coles. Fortunately, she was not hurt, but the bull had to be euthanized because of extensive injuries. Bystanders and sheriff's deputies teamed up to round up additional bulls and cows that had escaped through an open gate, roaming onto the grounds of a gas station next to the highway. Reporting for East County Magazine from Lakeside, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast. I'm Eric Tegedoff. Here are the stories in our rundown today. The FCC voted to begin rolling back net neutrality rules. Consumer groups are opposing what they call the mother of all anti-regulation bills in the U.S. Senate, And a new report finds the GOP health bill could be especially harmful for seniors and people with disabilities. The Federal Trade Commission voted 2-1 Thursday to review net neutrality rules, opening the door to undoing the Obama-era regulations that place strict oversight on cable and telecom companies. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai says the rules represent a bureaucratic straitjacket on the industry. Net neutrality rules ensure internet providers treat all web traffic equally and fairly. Stakeholders and the public have 90 days to weigh in. In more consumer news, Republicans in Congress are wasting no time making good on promises to roll back regulations they say hinder economic growth and jobs. Eric Galatis has more.
A bill making its way through the U.S. Senate is being challenged by business leaders and consumer groups. Proponents say the Regulatory Accountability Act will ensure that health and environmental regulations are transparent and based on the best available science. Critics say the law's true purpose is to make it impossible for federal agencies to pass any new protections. Beverly Hanstrom runs a medical waste disposal company in Aurora. She calls the move an effort by big business to pollute without accountability.
Why would we want less oversight? Everybody needs healthy food. Then there's the EPA. They're supposed to strengthen and enforce rules to protect clean air, clean water, clean land. Less is not going to be beneficial to anybody.
National environmental groups say the measure would essentially ban agencies from keeping pesticides and bacteria such as salmonella out of food, keeping lead out of water, and from preventing exposure to known carcinogens such as asbestos.
Alaska Natives are touring the Southwest this week, drumming up support for a bill in Congress to ban oil and gas drilling in parts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Two women from the Gwich'in tribe spoke in Tucson. They're showing a short film about the battle to save their ancestral homeland on the wildlife refuge and the porcupine caribou herd that sustains it. Bernadette Dementiev with the Gwich'in Steering Committee says her people have been fighting off development for 28 years because the herd is central to their way of life.
Just like the Native Americans with the buffalo, they have that spiritual and cultural connection. That's the same connection that we have to the porcupine caribou herd. The Gwich'in Nation used to migrate with the caribou herd for over 20,000 years. What befalls the caribou befalls the Gwich'in.
House Resolution 1889, the Udall-Eisenhower Arctic Wilderness Act, would designate as wilderness 1.5 million acres of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, protecting it from extractive industries. I'm Suzanne Potter.
A summit in Colorado this week outlined what could be new benchmarks for transforming the entire global economy.
The Regenerative Future Summit brought in top thinkers, economists, and sustainability experts to expand on the concepts of former J.P. Morgan investment executive John Fullerton, who realized after 2 decades in finance that the corporate system largely isn't working for humanity. Brian Weinberg is chief operating officer for Fuller's now 5-year-old endeavor, the Capital Institute, which he says aims to reconstruct the entire world economic model.
It's really the evolution of the sustainability movement, which is not, you know, break even, do less bad, but let's add value to the greater wholes that we're all a part of. And it's about systemic change.
Weinberg says the concept known as regenerative capitalism is picking up momentum across the globe. Part of the conference goal is to test the new economic theory on a micro level in localized regions.
That was Brett McPherson reporting. The GOP health bill that is now in the Senate would be especially harmful to seniors and people with disabilities, according to a new report. Andrea Sears has more.
With the per capita cap on Medicaid spending that would be imposed under the American Health Care Act, states would be forced to make cuts. And according to Judy Solomon with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Home and Community-Based Services, or HCBS, which allows seniors and people with disabilities to get the care they need in their homes, would be at the top of the list.
Most HCBS are what Medicaid considers optional services. In other words, states don't have to provide them, in contrast to care in a nursing home, which is mandatory and states must provide.
The report says almost 3 million Americans participate in HCBS, and capping Medicaid could force many into much more expensive nursing home care. With nearly 1 in 4 Americans age 65 and older living with diabetes, some organizations are spreading a message of get fit, don't sit during Older Americans Month in May.
The American Diabetes Association and Passport Health Plan are providing seniors with information about how they can live the healthiest lives possible. Health educator with Passport Health Plan, Lisa Bellafato, says exercise is a key diabetes prevention tool, and any additional movement that can be incorporated into daily life is beneficial.
For example, if you are with a group of people and you're having a meeting, you get up and do like a walking meeting, or just that you're standing for part of the time. Or if you are going to the grocery store, can you park a little further away and walk a little bit more?
She says regular physical activity can help people lose weight and lower blood sugar, which can help prevent diabetes or delay its onset. Mary Sherman reporting.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Victor Crosswhite Contreras. Victor is an actor and a proud member of Descendants of Early San Diego. Victor, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Now, we're here to talk about Twain Fest, which is coming up in August. Victor, can you tell us a little bit about what Twain Fest in Old Town is all about?
Named after Mark Twain.
Yes, and it's a celebration of literature of the 1800s. And certainly the Old Town State Park is an appropriate venue for this because it celebrates the history of California and the history of San Diego in the 1800s. Now they're hoping to expand the event. It's been a yearly one-day event, and they're pursuing grant funding to expand the event because it's been so popular to multiple days. But it is targeted for August. Whether we're going to be able to expand this year or not, where I'm not entirely sure. But one of the activities of Twain Fest is presentation of authors of the 1800s, but also historical characters, people that actually lived in the San Diego region.
So I understand that you are having a script writing contest, and it's not just for people who were residents of Old Town back then, but for the actual real-life historical stories of people from throughout the San Diego region. That would include East County and beyond. Tell us about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, because San Diego was a commercial hub that included much of what is now Mexico, East County, all of East County, all the way to the mountains and into to the desert, and all the way north, probably up to San Capistrano. So all of that would have been the San Diego region prior to the border.
So what are the rules for entering the contest?
Last year it was a contest. Now we've decided to change the format a little bit, and it's not a contest rather than a submission. And we're looking to build a library of scripts because as this event grows, the presentation should grow and we should have more stories, more of a collective. So we're hoping to build a library. We're hoping to make this an annual event.
Wonderful.
Now we are looking for real life people, people that actually lived here during the 1800s, to tell a little bit of their story.
So first person.
First person. And speaking to visitors to San Diego, mm-hmm. and telling something about the time. So it's not just their personal story, but it could be foods, it could be events, it could be culture, it could be clothing, things about the 1800s. So it's a story, and it gives you some information about the times as well.
I've seen some of these presented at past Twain Fest events, and they're absolutely marvelous listeners. Now, are there limits on how many words it can be or anything else that folks should know?
It's not limited by words, but limited by time. So we're looking for 2 to 10 minute segments.
Okay.
So we're not looking at major scripts. 2 to 10 minute segments, they would be compensated. Those that will be selected will be compensated $100. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that we're just doing for free. So they would be compensated $100 for the permission to use the scripts and have a professional actor actually perform them during Twain Fest.
Wonderful.
Yeah, the deadline for submissions is May 31st. The scripts will be read and evaluated, and those that are selected will be announced at the annual Descendants Weekend, which is the last weekend in June every year.
Very good. Now, you can get an application at descendantsearlysandiego.weebly.com. That's W-E-E-B-L-Y.com. descendantsearlysandiego.weebly.com. Or you can check out the Descendants of Early San Diego on Facebook. And now, listeners, we have a very special treat for you today. Victor Crosswhite Contreras, who's with us today, is going to be reading a script that was a winner performed in last year's Twain Fest. And this is the story of Joaquin Murrieta, a famous bandito, and apparently his story was the basis for the character Zorro of movie fame.
Absolutely. Zorro is actually a compilation of multiple bandits of the time. And so they created the legend of Zorro, but primarily based on the real life adventures of Joaquin Murrieta.
Fascinating. What else would you like our listeners to know about Joaquin Murrieta before you do the reading?
Well, actually, there's a lot of information in the story. Let me perform it for you first, and let's get into questions afterwards.
All right.
Which might be more provocative. We've been able to take some of these performances actually to schools, and we're hoping to do more of that. And we found that to be very provocative, not only when we perform them in Old Town, but especially when we perform them in schools, because it provokes a lot of questions and information, and we can discuss a lot of the history and events of early San Diego.
Well, very good. Then without further ado, we bring you, brought back to life from the 1800s, Joaquin Murrieta.
Yo soy Joaquin, and I rode with Murrieta and his band of men in the 1800s in California. We were soldiers of fortune, freedom fighters, and yes, bandidos. The newspapers, they would recount that Joaquin Murrieta was in Sacramento, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, San Diego, all on the same day. This be impossible. But you see, there was more than one Joaquin. Joaquin Murrieta had been a soldier in the Mexican army during the time of the war between the United States and Mexico. When Mexico she lose, he go back to his pueblo. Soon after, gold she was discovered in these Californias, and people from all over the world, they come to this California to seek their fame and fortune. So too Joaquin. He bring his family to California, and he stake out a claim to look for gold. But in the new California, there were new laws. The new government, they passed the foreign miners tax. This was where anybody could collect a tax on foreign miners. Foreign miners were defined as anybody who was not of European blood and did not speak English. So many of the people that were born and raised and grew all their life in California were considered foreigners in their own land. Joaquin, he make his claim. He set up his camp. He go to hunt for food for his family. When he returned, he found his camp destroyed. And everything of value should be taken. His beautiful wife, she was raped and killed. Her body lay on the camp floor. His children close by with their heads bashed in. He knew, as an ex-Mexican soldier who had just fought a war against the Americanos, he could find no justice in California. So he took up the life of a bandido. And he organized these men and trained them in military fashion so they had efficiency and they were hard to find. They would steal from stagecoaches, from miners, from rich Americanos, and they would give to the Spanish-speaking people in the area. And so the people, they would help Joaquin and he would yell, "Yo soy Joaquin," and they would cover for them and misguide the law enforcement that chase after him. We wear cape around our bodies so the people would know, "Yo soy Joaquin," that we were with Joaquin Murrieta, but they not see who it is because of the cape, and they do not know what Joaquin Murrieta looked like. But they know one of his lieutenants, Three Finger Jack, Tres Dedos. They know him because he loses a finger in a fight, and his hand only have three fingers. They find Tres Dedos. And so they set up an ambush where they kill all the men with Tres Dedos. They cut off the hand of Tres Dedos, and they cut off the head of Joaquin, and they take it on display up and down the California, and people pay ticket to go see the head and the hand. The head and hand, they be on display in San Francisco during the great San Francisco earthquake, and the head and the hand, they be lost again, and the Americanos are still in search of Joaquin Murrieta. But was that head Murrieta? Because after all, I am a bandido, and I, too, am Joaquin.
Marvelous. What a powerful story.
Thank you. And real.
And real. Yes, yes. Truth sometimes is stranger than fiction, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's so wonderful to look at real history and see what really happened. The legend of Zorro built on the real-life exploits of multiple bandits, Joaquin Murrieta being one of the foremost. But there were other bandits. For example, there was a bandit called Zorrillo. Zorro Zorrillo, not a Quantum Leap.
Okay.
And he's the guy that actually wore the mask.
Yeah.
The cape came from Joaquin. And many of the exploits that we attribute to Zorro or built around the legend of Zorro were in real life events that Joaquin Murrieta actually did.
You were telling me earlier about a fascinating escapade that he engaged in involving a dramatic escape on horseback. Tell our listeners about that.
It's an escape that you've seen in multiple movies, and it may have happened once or twice in real life, not as many times as we've seen in the movies, because it involves taking a horse to the edge of a cliff, and you've seen this in many movies, where bandits are following, or the sheriff is following, or the Indians are following, and this lone rider comes to an edge of a cliff, he makes his horse leap off the cliff and into the river, in which he escapes.
Which just seemed too far-fetched to be true.
It's very, very difficult to get a horse to jump down. It's against their nature, because it puts their legs in danger, and then they would die. So that's not something that they're willing to do readily. Joaquin Murrieta in real life was able to do that.
Wow, because he was an amazing horseman.
He was an amazing horseman, an amazing soldier.
And did the horses survive that?
His horse did.
Not the ones following him, necessarily.
No, the ones following him didn't. And not only was he a bandit, but many times he took on social issues. For example, there was a mining town that, of course, the miners, when they got off of mining, they were ready to have their drinks and raise hell.
Yeah.
And so there was a cantina. There was a woman that worked in the cantina. She was not a woman of the night. She worked as a waitress. But after they closed the bar down, some men took advantage of her.
What did Joaquin Murrieta do?
He posted the sign, "If there's not justice, you're going to pay it to me." They discounted her and said, well, she must have been a prostitute because she was working in a bar. So they discounted her and said there would be no prosecution. Joaquin came back with his men and burnt the town down.
Wow. He really sounds like there's a little bit of Robin Hood in him, from what you were telling me about him robbing from the wealthy and sort of redistributing that wealth a little bit to people in need. And all of his losses, the terrible losses he endured in his personal life, it kind of reflects that old adage about one person's villain is another person's freedom fighter. One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter.
Absolutely. And we certainly need to keep that in mind now in the political climate of today.
Yes.
We're villainizing the other side to an extreme, whatever side you're on.
Right. Or we have to be careful not to tar all people of a particular race because of the deeds of a handful of individuals is another lesson we can take from this.
Absolutely. We can't paint with a white brush.
No. So, once again, listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Victor Crosswhite Contreras. He's with the
Descendants of Early San Diego. And the parameters of our competition, just to remind our listeners, is due date for submission is May 31st. Winners will be announced the last weekend in June at the Descendants Reunion Weekend. They'll be assigned to professional actors that'll prepare them in July, and they'll be performed in August in Old Town State Park.
Well, we're certainly looking forward to seeing those historic stories of Old San Diego. And again, that includes the entire region, including stories here in East County. So listeners, if you have someone in your family with a story to tell, perhaps an ancestor, or you've just researched the history of your region and discovered an amazing historical character, please bring them to life in a script such as the one that Victor just performed for us today, and you can enter it in the contest, and perhaps, if you're lucky, you'll win that $100, and it'll be performed at Twain Fest in Old Town. Victor, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. Senator Dianne Feinstein has co-authored legislation to shield farm workers from deportation and put them on a path to earned legal status and eventual citizenship. Under the Agricultural Worker Program Act, farm workers who have worked in agriculture for at least 100 days in each of the past 2 years would be able to learn lawful blue card status if the bill is approved. Farm workers who maintain blue card status for the next 3 or 5 years, depending on the total hours worked in agriculture, would be eligible to adjust to a green card or legal permanent residency. Agriculture is a $54 billion industry in California, and UC Davis estimates that up to 70% of California farm workers, that's over 500,000 people, are undocumented. Under the Trump Justice Department's new immigration enforcement guidelines, they are all priorities for deportation. Senator Dianne Feinstein states, "Everywhere I travel in California, I hear from farmers, growers, and producers from all industries, wine, citrus, fruit and nut trees, dairy, that there aren't enough workers. Farm labor is performed almost exclusively by undocumented immigrants." By protecting farm workers from deportation, the bill achieves two goals: ensuring that hardworking immigrants don't live in fear and that California's agriculture industry has the workforce it needs to thrive. Senator Feinstein concludes, "We simply must protect the families who help put food on our tables." The bill, which has not yet been assigned a bill number, is supported by a coalition of labor and immigrant rights groups, but it is unclear whether it will have any chance of being heard amid the anti-immigrant stances of the leaders in the Senate, which has a slim Republican majority, let alone pass the House, which is firmly controlled by conservatives who have supported President Trump's calls for mass deportations. If deportation of farm workers is not stopped, Americans across the nation can expect to pay more for fruits and vegetables that could be left to rot in the fields if not enough workers can be found to pick them.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. The county medical examiner has ruled that a shooting death which occurred on the Viejas Reservation in Alpine on May 16th was a homicide. Lorenzo Alejandro Rodriguez, a 42-year-old Alpine resident, died of a gunshot wound to his torso. A 911 call initially reported a suicidal man at 31 Viejas Grade Road, said Lieutenant Greg Reilersdam with the Sheriff's Homicide Unit. Deputies found Rodriguez unresponsive, and emergency medical responders were unable to save him. An autopsy revealed the cause of death was not suicide, but rather homicide. Angela Meza, a 47-year-old Alpine resident, has been arrested and charged with murder. She pleaded not guilty. It is unclear what motivated the shooting. The victim, who was engaged to be married, left behind two young sons. His own father called him a dedicated father, posting on a GoFundMe page, "Lorenzo will truly be missed," adding that he will always be remembered and loved.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
We'll tell you about coming attractions, including a production of Into the Woods, open house at the Oasis Camel Dairy, La Mesa's Flag Day Parade, Fly Days at Gillespie Field, the annual Julian Dance and Barbecue, Fido Fest in Santee, Lavender Days at Summers Past Farms, Sundays at 6, concerts in La Mesa, Night Fishing at Santee Lakes, the Julian Blues Fest, Santee Summer Concerts, a Father's Day brunch with Cowboy Jack, and a Father's Day adventure at Fort Cross in Julian, filled with rugged, manly experiences.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Young Actors Theater presents Into the Woods starting May 25th through June 5th at the Encore Theater in Spring Valley. The performance takes everyone's favorite fairy tale characters and brings them together in an enchanting tale with a Tony Award-winning musical score. You can find tickets and details at yatsandiego.org.
The Baja Blues Boys, known for their original acoustic and electric blues plus roots, Americana and party music, will be performing at the Winola Pizza Express just outside of Julian on Friday, May 26th from 6 to 9 p.m. You can find details and directions at winolapizzaexpress.com.
The Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona invites you to an open farm day May 27th and 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. with a camel show at 1:30. Meet curious camels, take a camel ride, shop for camel milk soaps and camel milk goods, and visit a petting zoo. For details and directions, visit cameldairy.com.
La Mesa salutes Old Glory at the city's annual Flag Day Parade on Saturday, June 2nd. The parade begins at 10 a.m. in La Mesa's downtown village, led by the U.S. 3rd Marine Air Force Wing Band. You can also cheer on war heroes, equestrian groups, marching bands, and more. Guests are encouraged to wear red, white, and blue and show patriotic spirit. For more information, visit cityoflamesa.com/special events.
Air Group 1 and Gillespie Field Cafe invite you to Fly Days at Gillespie Field on June 2nd from 4 to 8 p.m. when the Gillespie Field Cafe comes alive with live music, hot rod cars, antique airplanes, and World War II aircraft. The Gillespie Cafe is located at 1921 North Marshall Avenue in El Cajon. For more information, you can visit gillespiecafe.com.
Sons of the American Legion will present the 11th Annual Julian Dance on June 10th from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. The Backcountry Dance and Barbecue features music by the Three Chord Justice and the California Rangers, a large dance floor, plus dinner, slow-cooked Santa Maria style over the open oakwood flames. Foods, wines, and beers are available for purchase. This event is described as a throwback to the simpler times with twinkly lights and bonfires backdropped by dark mountain skies. A time for mountain residents and visitors to get together for a great time. To listen to the bands or to get tickets, you can visit juliandance.org.
The city of Santee will be hosting Fido Fest on June 10th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. along with Camp Bow Wow. Fido Fest will be held at Town Center Community Park East. You can adopt a dog from any of the dozens of rescue groups on hand, win giveaways, enjoy live entertainment, get discounts on vaccinations, microchipping and dog licenses, and bid on silent auction prizes to benefit Dogs on Deployment, which helps deployed military members find volunteers to board their pets.
Summers Past Farms invites you to Lavender Days, along with an antique and craft fair, on Saturday, June 10th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Over 40 craftspeople will participate, offering up crafts, collectibles, antiques, and a garden sale on Summers Past's spacious lawn. You can fill your baskets with many types of lavender plants, as well as lavender soaps, candles, and garden salve. Plus, enjoy music by Jim Earp. Guests are encouraged to wear lavender and savor the scents of the south of France during your day at the farm. Summers Pass Farms is located in Flint Springs, just east of El Cajon. For directions and details, visit summerspassfarms.com.
La Mesa's Summertime Sundays at 6 concert season begins June 11th and will be held each Sunday evening at 6 p.m. through July 23rd at Harry Griffin Park. Opening night will feature the San Diego Concert Band on June 11th. Other performers this season will include Ginger Cowgirl, Fanny and the Attaboys, Dim the Lights, Fringe Benefits, and Sonic Epidemic. Music styles over the season include show tunes, country, bluegrass, jazz, blues, disco, classic rock, and horn tunes of the 70s. For more information, visit lamesaparks.org.
You're invited to come drop a line during night fishing at Santee Lakes on Thursday, June 15th from 5 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. Bring a lantern. For details, visit santeelakes.com.
Santee kicks off its summer concert series with the Cadillacs on June 15th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Town Center Park East. This event also features a classic car show, kids' activities, and picnic-style seating, as well as food trucks.
Fort Cross and Julian invites you to bring Dad for a Father's Day adventure on June 17th that includes rugged, manly fun things like a tomahawk throwing competition, archery contest, and paintball slingshot area. The family can enjoy a petting zoo, sunset hayride, dinner, and playing jug band instruments around a campfire. You can spend the day or even camp overnight. A community campfire will be provided for breakfast and dinner. Bring your own picnic foods, or you can purchase foods at restaurants within a block from Fort Cross. Space is limited for this manly Father's Day adventure. You can reserve tickets for dear old Dad and the whole family at fortcross.com.
The 19th Annual Julian Blues Festival is set for June 17th at Mangini Winery. This year's lineup includes Philip Sace, Dennis Jones, Earl Thomas, Ben Robinson, and the McCoy Brothers, and on the back porch stage, the Chris Fast Band. This event is produced by Rob Bauer. Tickets are available at rob-bauerpresents.com.
Pine Hills Lodge will host a Father's Day brunch on Sunday, June 18th. Cowboy Jack will sing traditional country music from Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, and more, also playing acoustic guitar and harmonica. Cowboy Jack Johnson is the lead singer from the band In Black and singing cowboy at Rawhide Ranch. For reservations and details, visit pinehillslodge.com.
That's all for this week.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.